All right. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the annual report work group meeting for the fiscal year 2024 cycle. Seth Pazinski, I am the ONC designated federal officer for the HITACH. I want to remind all the work group members that the meetings are open to the public and that the public feedback is welcome throughout. Members of the public can type comments into the Zoom chat feature throughout the meeting. And then we do have time at the end of the agenda to make verbal public comments as well. I'm going to begin the call with a roll call of the work group members. So when I call your name, if you can indicate that you are present, and I will start with our co-chairs, Medell Briggs-Melanson.
Good afternoon, everyone.
Good afternoon. Elia Oliveira.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Hans Butendijk.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Hannah Galvin. Jim Jurgis.
Present.
Anna McAllister.
I'm here. Sorry, I was on mute.
Yeah. Shiloh Blen.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Sarah DeSilvi unfortunately could not make today's call. Steve Eichner.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. And Daya Oshukantan.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Rochelle Proffer.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. All right. Anyone I missed or who joined a few minutes late? Okay. Thank you. Now I'd like to turn it back over to Medell and Eliel for their opening remarks.
Thank you so much, Seth. And it is such a pleasure, as always, to be with the annual report work group. This is going to be another exciting meeting because we actually get to dive even more into the potential topics for the annual report. So really looking forward to having a very concise yet highly informative meeting today. Eliel, I'll turn it on over to you.
Yeah, thanks, Medell, and thanks, Seth, everyone, for joining. We're excited about moving forward with the work group and for the topics that you all raised last time. It was a great discussion. There's so much to talk about, so let's dive into it.
Great.
Back to you, Medell.
Thank you. And what we'll do right now is we'll quickly go on over the meeting agenda as well as some of the various different aspects of our annual report work group. So one of the things we're going to move more into is communicating and using HITACH annual reports. There was a large amount of discussion about some of our prior annual reports and how we've been able to effectively use them to influence as well as guide some of the additional charges and discussions that have taken place not only in ONC, but also in other areas as well. Then we'll go over and talk about discussion of work group plans, discussion of potential topics for the HITACH annual report work for fiscal year 2024. Again, we did go over some of the ones that were recommended previously from the HITACH, but we also want to make sure that we're incorporating all of the various different ideas and voice from our work group here today. And then we'll end by public comment and then talk about the next steps and adjourn from there. Next slide. Great. This once again is just the overall membership as well as ONC staff, as was mentioned. And thank you, Seth, already for all of our roll call. Wonderful. And Seth, I think we'll turn it back on over to you for to give an update on communicating and using the HITACH annual reports.
All right. Thank you, Medell. So I wanted to just respond to a few of the items, as Medell highlighted, that were discussed on the prior call. So just wanted to clarify one scoping question and then talk about ways that ONC communicates the HITACH annual reports, and then also pose for discussion how we can really maximize the use of the HITACH annual reports as well. So I'm going to give a few remarks, and then I think we'll have potentially a few minutes for questions. So to start off, one of the questions that came up at the kickoff meeting was around the ability for HITACH through the annual report to make recommendations to Congress on legislation and funding gaps. So I did want to clarify that, yes, that is in scope. So the HITECH annual report can identify existing gaps in policies and resources and provide recommendations to address those gaps. The one caveat on that I did want to note is that those gaps must be connected to either furthering interoperability or achieving the ONC objectives and benchmarks. So this is specifically called out both the authority to address gaps in policies and resources and related recommendations, and then aligning those to the advancing interoperability and achieving ONC objectives and benchmarks in the legislative requirements for the HITECH annual report. So hopefully that provides some clarity on one of the discussion questions that came up at the kickoff meeting. And next, I wanted to just give a little bit of background into how the HITECH annual report gets delivered to the Secretary and to Congress. So by statute, the HITECH annual reports are required to go to Congress and to the Secretary of Health and Human Services. And so that happens in a few steps. So HITECH votes and approves the annual report, and then the HITECH co-chairs through a signed transmittal memo submit the annual report to the national coordinator. Once that happens, ONC staff, so folks like myself and Michelle Murray, who you're familiar with, on behalf of the HITECH will submit the annual report to the Secretary of HHS. And there's an official correspondence system for submitting things to the Secretary, so we use that process. And then we also, on behalf of the HITECH, facilitate the submission of the annual report to Congress. So HHS has an executive secretariat, or ExecSec, as we like to call it for short. And ExecSec manages HHS development and review of regulations and correspondence, as well as reports to Congress. So ExecSec directly supports the Secretary and the Deputy Secretary of HHS and works across all the divisions of HHS and with other federal agencies. So ONC staff work with the HHS Executive Secretariat, as well as the HHS Assistant Secretary for Legislation. And the Assistant Secretary for Legislation is the one who formally submits the annual report via assigned memo to Congress. On the Congress side, the memo is delivered specifically to the Senate Committee on Finance, the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions, or HELP Committee, the House Ways and Means Committee, the House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology, and then the House Energy and Commerce Committee. Once that occurs, also there is an ONC legislative team that coordinates legislative matters within the agency, as well as with the Assistant Secretary for Legislation. And that team helps confirm that the HITECH annual reports have been received by those congressional committees that I previously mentioned, and also helps point to the annual reports as relevant in supporting communications between Congress and HHS. Yeah, Jim, I see you have your hand raised.
Yeah, with any report like this, one of the questions is, who actually reads it? Because is it mostly the health committees? And do you have evidence that by submitting this report, like who responds to it? Do we ever get questions? And who's the main audience that's actually, I know it's a broad group we're sending it to, but mm-hmm. I got to believe senators that are not involved in the health committee might not have time to read. So who is our usual customer for this report? And then what ends up happening to it? Because from my perch, we submit it and then I'm not sure we hear much. And then the next year we submit another one. So can you give us a little taste of that?
Yeah, sure. So we at times through reports to Congress that ONC submit, will get questions from Congress or meeting requests. Those are all kind of managed through the HHS Assistant Secretary for Legislation. So that's the formal group within the Department of Health and Human Services on behalf of ONC, who will coordinate the communications between ONC and the Hill. Typically, in my experience, it'll be, a health policy lead within the congressional member's office who would be, engaging on substantive, matters that ONC is communicating on. Fidel?
Thank you. Thank you for all of these explanations, Seth. And Jim, mm-hmm. I know that you have served on this annual report work group for several years, in which we're so appreciative. But Seth, would you say that still our primary customer is still ONC by far, just because of the fact that we are an advisory committee for ONC and for health information technology? Would you say that we have primary customers and then we also have the secondary, as you're just mentioning?
Yeah, so I'll talk maybe, and this will help sort of differentiate a few different ways that the committee can leverage the annual reports and sort of focus the content. So definitely ONC, primary customer for the HITECH annual reports. And one of the ways that, in particular, I would say is we use the annual reports as our primary driver for developing the annual HITECH work plans. So typically we'll present the ONC objectives and benchmarks, and that's a statutorily required step. We present those to the HITECH. That's usually in the fall timeframe. And those get incorporated into the HITECH annual report. And so that's sort of like ONC's perspective on, what our priorities are in the coming years. And then, the remainder of the HITECH annual report is a committee sort of perspective on the different topics and what the potential is for the committee to take on those topics. So it's the primary resource we use in agenda setting for the committee. And I can put a link in the chat too that breaks down. We have sort of the historical record. So each of the task forces and work groups that kind of happen each year, and that includes all the HITECH annual reports. You'll generally see that there's about 3 to 4 subcommittees of HITECH that occur each year. And so some of those are where ONC is putting something forward, like a proposed rule or a draft USCDI version, and the committee's responding to those. And then some of them are more kind of open topics, like public health data systems, for example, where the committee kind of is broadly looking at a segment of the health value chain and providing feedback to ONC. But we really leverage the annual reports to figure out what are those topics that we want to charge the committee to dig into. We also use it as a source for emerging issues. So, one of the things that the annual reports lay out is kind of like, these are the things that are pressing right now. These are the things that the HITECH sees as items that are coming down the line that might want to be addressed in a few years. So that helps inform us on what are the potential issues that ONC needs to be aware of from that are emerging within industry, and what are the things where we may want to take some action on, what are the things that we are more in kind of a monitor posture on to track along with a committee. Or what are the things that maybe ONC taking a position on would help provide clarity, to industry. So agenda setting for both our own work as an agency and for the HITECH, as well as having an understanding of what, the industry identifies those key issues that are bubbling up that are likely to, come to the table in the next couple of years. So those are really, how we as ONC, as a primary recipient of the document, use it, each year.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Seth. Are there any other questions regarding the communication as well as the utilization of our HITECH annual report and how best that we can leverage this report in the future? Any additional questions for Seth? Okay. All right.
Okay. I'm just going to highlight just one example to show sort of how that life cycle can start with an annual report and ultimately come back, to the HITECH leader. Public health data systems is a great example where the committee the high-tech annual report elevated public health as a priority target area. And that subsequently led to two separate task forces that were focused on public health that informed HHS as it was coordinating internally on its plans for public health data systems modernization. And that just last week, you know, that came kind of full circle where we're having a conversation around USCDI public health initiatives and getting the committee's feedback. So, you know, that's one example, but that just can kind of show you where, how something being elevated through the annual report can inform subsequent work at the high tech and ultimately, you know, lead to action on behalf of ONC as an agency and the department as a whole. So did just want to share that example.
Excellent example. Thank you so much, Seb. Any additional questions? Okay. Well, thank you, Seth. This was very informative because we did have a robust conversation. I think you were able to provide some additional insight into how these reports truly do go forward and influence change. So we appreciate you. Eliel, I'll turn it on over to you.
Thanks, Madel. Can we move to next slide, please? Let's dive in on the discussion of our work group plans next. So this is the calendar of our schedule of meetings coming up, you know, for the month. As you see today, we are moving forward with our developing our list of topics. And then early in July, we're gonna start working on the crosswalk of topics for the annual report all the way to the end of August. And you see in a minute how those, you know, relate very well to the high tech meetings where we present to the high tech and receive feedback and make adjustments and develop a draft of the annual report in September and October, then update that final draft for approval. And we may be ready to submit then at that point to Congress. So next slide. And here are the full high tech committee meetings. As you can see in July, we update on the status of the report development and then with the discussion topic list. And then by August, after we have discussed the crosswalk, we update again the team where we are. In September, we go through the updated status of the report, review the draft with the feedback in October from the high tech, the whole group. And then in November, we approve the final version of the annual report. Next. And so to just summarize that, the work plan for the annual report work group, we have a compressed timeline this time, as you can see, until the end of the year. Previous years, for those of you that have been here before, usually we are submitting to Congress in February. So now we want to make sure that this is on a yearly calendar. So we're gonna try to have this completed before December. So lots of topics and less time. So we, as you saw in the list, we developed the potential topics to present to high tech in July, which we have been working on. Then we will work on the crosswalk document over the summer and present to the high tech in August. And I think you all have seen the crosswalk document so far. Then we are going to review the draft report in September and present it to high tech in October. And after those edits, you know, and high tech votes to approve the report and transmit to the coordinator in November. And at that point, after the final review, the ONC forwards the report to the Secretary in Congress and post that by the end of the year. And that's our plan. Next slide, please. I'll turn it back to you, Nadal, to walk us through the topics now. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much, Eliel. And I think we'll tag team on this a little bit as well, because we really want to make sure that there's a large amount of robust conversation. So we're going to go directly into the potential topics for the annual report for fiscal year 2024. And once again, remember, the work group's insights as well as their recommendations are so incredibly important. So we do want to hear some of your thoughts on these topics. Next slide. So this was a little bit of a quick overview of the prioritization that came directly from ONC. And you all remember it was really almost like three different tiers with a true focus of really thinking more about health equity data, LTPACs, community-based and social drivers of health data exchange, consent management and sensitive data, as well as laboratory and pharmacy standards, with the second tier of ONC's priorities, really thinking of algorithmic bias and transparency, information blocking, impact and infeasibility exception, third-party apps beyond HIPAA, and then safety and security of mobile health apps. And we can also include, of course, data integrity and quality into some of those areas, but we know data integrity and quality have actually been across many different domains. And then you have the third area, which is here as well for everyone to see in terms of improvements in patient matching methodologies, interoperabilities, as well as patient-reported EHR update processes, and then also some additional pieces on data. Next slide, please. And potential topics for the HITECH annual report. We are going to finish up with the next list of those potential topics that were provided to us directly from HITECH. However, we really want to use the vast majority of today's meeting in order to see, A, are there any questions or comments about those topics that have already been proposed? But most importantly, are there topics that we should add that are currently not on the list? And so that was also a question that was asked to the HITECH, and we did get one or two additional recommendations, but we also want to know directly from everyone here as who's part of the annual report work group. And I believe this is the last slide. So maybe we can bring up the topics and then Eliel, I'll turn it on over to you for us to start going back through some of those topics. Thank you so much, Excel.
Thank you. So I think maybe if the members have had a chance to walk through the topic list, great. If not, we're gonna have a little bit of time to go through those right now. As you can see here, we are considering interoperability standards, labs, and pharmacy data aspects, supporting image and interoperability and privacy of sensitive health data consent. I believe, Medel, that we covered some of those overviews last time. So my thinking here is that we go quickly over all of them so everybody refreshes their memory and then come back to see what other topics recommended, suggested to be added or removed.
Correct, so. Eliel. I believe the red is what Michelle and the rest of the team, they added from our conversation from our last meeting. And then there is farther down is where we stopped last meeting. So to your point, to go over those new areas and then we can see if there's any additional topics as well.
Okay. So with that said, maybe Excel team, if we can scroll down briefly to the rest of the list to just see what else we have for the team to be aware, a refresher. So we had PGD, patient generated data, and quite a bit of edit here with some of the comments we heard last time, patient burden and workflow, and artificial intelligence, as you all know. And if we can keep it scrolling down, optimizing public health data exchange and infrastructure, long-term and post-acute care interoperability, health equity by design, and can we keep going? We'll come back to the top again in a second. Health equity as well, behavioral health, further improvement of data quality and sharing, lack of accounting of disclosures. And as you can see, some of those are the topics that were in our list of wishful topics to add to this year, and transparency in the use of de-identified data. And is that's it? I thought so. So just high level, that's what we covered. We, of course, can go over the specific edits that we made last time, but that's the topic list. And I see Rochelle has a question and thought, comment. We can't hear you somehow.
Rochelle, we can't hear you.
You can't, are you
now? We can.
Okay, sorry about that.
Very low, but still.
I'm okay. I'll have to speak up louder. I've been having some technical issues since the heavy flooding in Miami all last week. So hopefully it'll get better. Let me know, just let me know if you can't hear me. In the high tech meeting last week, I had mentioned some issues that didn't get transcribed yet. And so I wasn't able to add them to the list. You had mentioned that I should bring them up here. Was it? Yes. Okay. So that's what I'm trying to do today.
Yes. And Rochelle, you're 100% correct, because they were much broader kind of sweeping recommendations. And do you remember, do you mind recapping for us?
I think we were talking about AI and the use of and its use in women's health and how it can be used punitively depending on where we are in the states and how we can address this federally. Although we've been able to put some privacies in place around certain aspects of women's health that would equate to the equivalence of privacy with HIV, but we need to go a little bit further because of certain specific use case scenarios of what's going on politically in the country. But there is such a divergence between where you are, depending on access and what is collected, that can pose real potential health disparities in use of the data, how that structured the consent, the lack of transparency, et cetera. And I was bringing up how other entities are using our data as data grabs in ways unimaginable. Not going to mention them here, but it was specifically targeting certain sectors of the community just to do a proposed study, but it doesn't actually resolve a clinical issue. And they're not fully being transparent on what they're trying to do with our data, who's the owners, how is that structured, and how we can go forward in preventing the use of our healthcare data in ways that aren't harmful, but promotes the advancement for all.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you so much, Rochelle, for summarizing that. And it almost is like two separate topics, I'm wondering. In terms of privacy of sensitive health data, one of the things that we also included in our annual report last year is privacy of sensitive health and reproductive data. We actually kind of broadened that. And even right now on the screen, we have privacy of sensitive health data. And I'm wondering, and this is just for the work group and also for you, if this is another time, that, because that was one of the comments that and changes we made last year, because of the same exact, some of the concerns that you're bringing up right now were the concerns that we also had last year, which were incorporated into the annual report work group. So it would be interesting to cross-reference what we also discussed last year and kind of refine it and reiterate it maybe, especially with some of those additional points that you're bringing up around the privacy and the consent of this data as well. And then also what you were referring to, which is about overall consent and privacy of our data, it sounds like even outside of sensitive data, and the importance of making sure that there is full transparency of that is also. So those are, I think those are two really good points to add up, and whether we expand upon one of these current topics to incorporate it, or we actually add an additional topic to those as well.
That's what you had recommended mm-hmm. for me to do. So I'm fully on board with that.
Great.
So I see some additional hands, so I will defer.
Mattel, this is Steve. I think it's both health and personal data, not just reproductive health, which is a subset, maybe a subset of health data, but really looking at personal data, which may include some health data or other things that aren't necessarily health data, but are someone may consider to be personal or pseudo health data, depending on your circumstance.
Yeah, I agree. That's a great way of putting that. And so that is more comprehensive. I know last year we were focused specifically on some of the legislation that had just came out, but that makes sense. I like that very comprehensively.
Thank you.
Hans?
Thank you. Question that I have or comment on this topic. To what extent do we need to, and it's a couple fold, to what extent do we need to consider the difference between privacy rules established by jurisdictions and challenges with that versus consent rules defined by the patient, assuming they have been accepted as appropriate to be followed, and how to manage that? There seems to be two parts. They come together because the combination will tell us what we can share or not share. But there seem to be two sides of that coin of understanding the rules and which one apply from a jurisdictional perspective and what are the rules that apply from a patient perspective once agreed to. So that's one part on trying to figure out how is it relevant to include that in here from an interoperability perspective and from a evaluation perspective. We always recognize there are two parts to that story. And what they have in common clearly is that in order to make that more computable so that we can manage that more easily rather than a written narrative that needs to be interpreted is the question of what constitutes sensitive health data, sorry, or sensitive data in light of the other comments just made. So what is that? And I think it is partly that we want to recognize there in the solution direction that there is an aspect of specific codes, diagnosis, medications, on their own or in combination, as well as categorization of data, because it's inside a document, it's inside a data set that you need to have a sense of, does it contain any sensitive data? You do not necessarily have immediate access to the content, but you can mark the set overall as a document or otherwise. So I think it's when we talk about sensitive health data, I think we need to recognize it is the specific codes that we can assess and evaluate and include as part of a rule one way or the other, or categorization of certain data, because you do not have access to that individual data yet.
Those are excellent points, Hans. I think the one is specifically on jurisdiction. It almost makes me think that we need a specific structure for consent that, you know, define things like the boundaries of what that consent allows from a jurisdiction perspective. You know, if it's a county level, a state level, a federal level, you know, that you're authorizing that consent, and you know, that becomes very helpful. I think, for instance, we, you know, worked on the mental health consent in California, and, you know, everybody's wondering, okay, can we replicate that in other states? And if someone consents in one, that applies elsewhere. So I think that's a very, very important aspect. And I think on the imaging, the same goes for, you know, notes. Where there is a lot of data buried in the notes as they are in images, that's really hard to detach the two. And research has shown us that it's very difficult sometimes to just do that. So we can probably learn a little bit there how machine learning researchers are trying to do that work of extracting pieces of information out of notes. I don't know. I feel like it might be a bit off still, given that we haven't even started on a consent model and one that even cross regions like you described. So anyways, I'm repeating a bit here to just say these are excellent points. Thank you so much for those.
Now, while we've got it identified later on, disclosure practices and disclosure information or communicating where disclosures have occurred are tied kind of hand in hand. It's one thing to have a security practice about the technical aspects of disclosing data. It's another thing to talk about the disclosure practices about when data is actually being disclosed and what's the accountability of those disclosures.
Thanks, Stephen. And I'll make a comment on that. I don't know, I don't remember who in this group here was in the previous work group last year, this annual report work group, but we talk extensively about that specific topic and just realize how hard it would be to, it is already to track account of disclosures in current EHR systems and not whatnot. And so it doesn't change the challenge here, you know, with the consent aspect adds to it. So very important though to
well, we don't take tasks because they're easy. We undertake tasks because they need to get done. And we might not have a perfect model for looking at accountability and disclosures, but I would think even at a minimum, looking at a disclosure that's going out of the entity where there's already tracking about that disclosure for other purposes would not be a terribly difficult bottom rung to at least improve, at least provide patients some understanding about where that data is actually being disclosed.
Exactly. Thanks, I.
Yeah, I think I was going to say, I think it's worth taking a look at that as another potential topic. And this year, since of just seeing what we as high tech can recommend around space. So it may definitely be worth doing that from what Ike was mentioning.
Yes. I see Rochelle, you have your hand up. Thoughts?
Yes, and thank you, Hans, for saying all that I was inarticulate in saying without full disclosure, but if anyone wants to go on LinkedIn, they can see what I'm talking about. But I really thank you for bringing up those topics, because I think that there is a lot of devil in the details on how this is being used. Yes, we can put algorithms together. We can try to do our best to prevent it in certain aspects, but encourage it in others. But at the end of the day, we want to know how it's going to impact the patient and or the end user. And what we don't want is that it becomes so onerous for the patient that they have to do this self-reporting in multiple surveys or having to constantly repeat something that's already in there. And then you really lose a sense of who's responsible at the end of it and who do you contact in order to turn that pipeline off. And I know Anna is probably going to talk about a lot of these aspects, but I see your hand up. And I know that you started talking about some of it in the annual report lower down, but Hans, thank you so much. I applaud you because these are some of the things that keep me up at night. And I really wasn't able to articulate the future use and all of the interoperability that comes with that. So thank you.
Thanks, Rochelle. Yeah, that's already is the case, right? In other situations as well, where we continue to ask of individuals to provide data and information and outcomes, patient reported outcomes or SDOH needs assessments that we ask basically everywhere they go, as opposed to having a unified approach that once someone provides some information, whether this is a consent or just details about a survey, that, you know, you guys know this well, family history and all those medical details you have to provide, you know, to every provider you go. There's a paper, you know, and a little, you know, you fill up those forms pretty much everywhere you go, again and again. So that becomes very taxing on patients. And I saw that we had Jim and Anna. I still wanted to see if you had any comments.
I took my hand down because there was a point I wanted to raise, but I'm not sure this is the right place to raise it. I mean, the right time in the meeting to raise it. One of the things that I'll just say what it is, and you can tell me whether we should pick it up at a different time. One of the things that I've been pushing for years and mentioned, and we talked through in a couple of different contexts on high tech last year, and I believe in the annual report, but I honestly can't remember, was the giving ONC or asking ONC to require or incentivize some sort of disclosure of how data is used. I mean, it's I'm all for data to be used after it's been de-identified for research of all different types. I think it's good. I think it's helpful. But I think for that to be done in a way where patients really understand the benefit of that, it needs to be, we need to be told what's happening with that data and what types of research is being done. You know, I've been able to convince one of my clients to do this, and it was an incredibly positive experience. Patients loved it. With all the uses of de-identified data, and patients were very excited to see, even patients that are a little skeptical of like the use of de-identified data and the commercialization of data, were very excited to see how their data had been used to support research. And I think this would be a healthy addition to building out this ecosystem. I don't know what kind of ONC jurisdiction or what kind of jurisdiction ONC might have in this case, but I do think it's something that if we're serious about building data resources out, not just for treatment, but also treatment flowing into research, that it's important for everybody to be able to have a sense of what's happening. So I guess I did raise it now.
Excellent. Thank you. And I think I as you're speaking about it, I'm thinking about IRB and how they have systematic processes to validate and make sure that patients know exactly what should and not be done when they are part of a specific research project. And it seems to me that maybe a lot of that can be leveraged here, those experiences with patient consent as well. So
yeah, I mean, if we get into consenting everybody to do secondary research, research using secondary uses of data, it's never going to happen. I don't necessarily think that's a constructive way of thinking about it. I think disclosing and letting people know what's being done with it is important, because there's a lot of really good stuff that's being done with this, and for people to really have a sense and to trust that this is something that needs to happen, they need to be able to see what that is.
Indeed. Jim, I see your hand up.
Yeah, on the same topic, it seems like disclosure often ties really closely to consent, right? Because as the patient sees how their data is being used, it leads to questions. Well, why is that person? Why are they, you know, using it for that, right? So I guess one question is there models? I mean, it seems like it's easier said than done. If you're just a single EMR, and it's one thing to tell your patients as a practice what you're doing with their data, if anything. But as the data jumps from place to place, are there simplified models that, number one, are actually doable from an operations and technical perspective? And number two, generate message back, you know, information to the patient that they can actually understand, right? I did this at a big medical center, just a single Vanderbilt. And, you know, we encourage people to look at their own records, right? If their job required that they got in the EMR, our stance was, you have the right to look at your own record, right? But we were worried that others would look at their record. That shouldn't, right? And so we tried to audit it, but the terminologies, I mean, even understanding where the data is going, came back such gibberish that we couldn't even understand what was happening, let alone translate it for the patient. So I guess one question is there something high tech could recommend about the development of simplified models that are operational, define the right level of disclosure,
and how data may be used in a secondary manner that is understandable to patients and operationalizable in this new world of interoperability? Because it seems like a pretty big challenge. Is that something that HITECH could recommend?
Elia, my comment is directly to both Anna and Jim. So I think that this is a fantastic thing to add to HITECH. And of course, you all know that I'm going to put on my kind of health services research, public health and health equity hat with this. And I think, Jim, to your point, you know, one thing that I actually did implement within my health system, which has been adopted by others, it's very simple, but we've now started to use this model in many different ways, is that we did have, for instance, even when we were collecting all of the self-reported various different forms of data, especially demographic data and other information which people may consider to be protected sensitive data, We did and still do have a disclaimer of saying, this is why we're collecting this data. And the whole purpose of the data is to provide you better care, as well as to help to provide better care to all the different populations and communities. And we had a disclaimer that was created and vetted by many of our patient and family advisory committees to make sure the language A was always at a grade level 6 or below, but then also that it was just clear and that it did, and it made sure to communicate what it needed to communicate in a way that was acceptable to various different patients throughout. And we actually have had a very successful uptake and also reaction to these disclaimers, with collecting data and using the data for various different reasons. We've had an uptake of over 90% from our patients, especially our new patients, and then also established patients. And we've now started to use those same type of disclaimers in other areas too, saying this data may be shared, but if this data is shared, this is what it's shared for. And I do think that if we're able to develop more disclaimers that, again, are very concise, they are at the appropriate literacy level for everyone, which is why it should be at grade 6, regardless of the population it's used in. And then also just in a way that we make sure our patients are involved in the process, I think it can be very meaningful. And it can actually increase our abilities to do so much more in terms of patient care, public health efforts, research, you name it.
Thanks, Mandel.
In terms of models, I'd be more than happy to share the report that that my client did. It was a publicly traded genetic testing company. They issued, a report, and then we've done two reports. Unfortunately, the company just declared bankruptcy and was just purchased, but I'm no longer working with them. But it was a great report. And again, it's basically what they did with all the aggregated de-identified data. This company did actually give patients the ability to choose not to have their data used as part of the aggregate data, which I think is a gold standard practice. But, whether or not we want to go there with ONC is a different question. As opposed to what this company chose to do, when we were working through data governance. But the report in and of itself, it was incredibly impressive in terms of how this de-identified, secondary use of data had been used to, develop the science of genetics and medical genetics. And again, patients who were very active in the patient groups that whose data was represented, we're very excited about it. So I'm happy to send it out. I don't know if ONC wants to create models, maybe I'll let ONC figure that out, but at least to encourage or incentivize in some way, if that's possible, the disclosure of how data is used, because there's a lot of data that's being used. And there are a lot of companies that are making a lot of money, based off the fact that, once it's been de-identified through HIPAA. I'm all for that. I just want to know what it is. If there's a market for it, the data is going to be better quality. So I'm all for that, but I just want to know what's being done with it. It's my personal opinion.
Yeah, thanks. And I see Jim's comments on the chat, and I agree with Mandel. is that I think we're talking about quite a bit here, right? We started with consent, now disclosures, and data level, set level. Go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, so one quick question, make sure we're all talking about the same thing. When we say disclosure, what is being done with my data? There's different levels of it. There's the announcement that, hey, this might be done for research to further knowledge and improve treatments. And then there's specifically Dr. John Smith's research center is going to be looking at breast cancer attitudes, opinions, right? So, and that's just the research side. Then there's treatment, payment, operations. So are we saying, like, what does it mean to disclose how the data is going to be used for treatment? That's what I meant by, is it general, or is it if the patient wants to know exactly which nurses and doctors looked at it, or which, you know, if we're talking the latter, then that implies a unified terminology, for someone to know that Billy Jones looked at their record. Well, why did Billy Jones look at the record? Maybe Billy Jones is not a nurse in their primary care practice, but was a float nurse who usually works somewhere else. And that confuses the patient, right? So that's what I mean by how granular do we think is it appropriate for us to make recommendations around version one? What level of granularity is doable? Because mm-hmm. if you get real granular within each of these permissible uses, then you end up with lots of data problems and translation to patients' sixth grade level challenges. So, yeah. Oh. Go ahead.
I was going to say very quickly, fully agree with you, but I think that we can, I look at this as like a larger ecosystem universe, and then there's subsets within each one of those universes. However, I think if we have clear principles that are recommended, so for instance, I'm thinking more about the process versus the exact content, if that makes sense, and the principles of disclosure, that when we do disclose to patients, that it should be, you know, should have certain recommendations in terms of the appropriate literacy status or the translation to specific languages. It should also include in general what that data should be used for. And then of course, if we're going more into that very subset specific forms of data where there's truly going to be real research for a specific cause, I feel that that data should not only incorporate those same principles, those same general principles, but then yes, there's going to need to be some additional information for that patient to be able to understand how their data may be used for that particular study. But I think in general, even having the principles of how to write appropriate patient directed disclosures is an area that at least I'm not quite, I know that Seth just put something in terms of privacy practices, but something that is a little bit more applicable and will be more impactful when it comes to educating our patients.
From really quickly, from a patient perspective, I'm often less interested in a specific person that may have looked at a particular piece of data, but knowing that they're a person that's a member of my care team and understanding who's a member of my care team and the data that's being accessed for my personal care is usually sufficient. So if you think about kind of from a tiered perspective, is the data being used for my personal care by my care team? Is it being shared more broadly for research purposes? Is it shared more broadly for customer service improvement purposes at the hospital? There are some, I think, fairly broad nets that can be used in most cases. You're not trying to look at data ad infinitum at a super granular level. I think there are some general thrusts or general direction that may be sufficient for almost every use case.
So can I make a quick comment there? So even there, when you said, is it being looked at by and used by someone on my care team? I don't know that we have a definition of care team. And it, you know, there's different levels of abstraction of that. For example, where we ran into problems trying to create this disclosure was if the member of care team is Dr. Gerges, his nurse, his secretary, and other staff that work, does it include other staff that might cover at lunch? does it include the traveling nurse that comes in, right? So the logistics of defining that, I wonder if high tech can weigh in on how to define what is my care team? Because what happens is they see a name on there and it's not someone that's on their care team. And then that generates a bunch of angst and work only to find out it was a nurse that's not typically on my care team who was covering that day. I know it sounds like an edge case, but it turns out it wasn't. It ended up, we had to stop the program because that level of granularity, the computers just couldn't explain and understand well. And I'm not being negative. I'm saying there might be an opportunity for high tech to define an appropriate level that doesn't create those unintended confusion consequences.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's probably a happy balance if we can figure out what it is.
Yeah, basically don't get too granular too quickly until you learn more. And until the computers can categorize everything correctly.
Thank you both. Those are some great points and highlight how complex this is, right? Between disclaimers and disclosures and consent management and whatnot for different purposes. I think we have certain things already well established, like I was saying, for research, what can be done and not done, and under HIPAA as well with TPO regulations. But I think we all saying here the same thing, that we still have a lot of challenges on how to capture and report on these efficiently. I want to pass it on. I see Anna has hands up. I do wanted to see also if we have other topics that we wanted to discuss. We've spent quite a bit of time here, and that's fine because it's that important. But maybe we wanted to talk about other things as well. So Anna, go ahead.
I just want to make one final statement. I mean, we're kind of talking about two different things. In my mind, they're two different things. One is disclosure of access to my personal data, like everybody. And I think that's important. And actually, there was two different work groups, I think, two different task force groups as part of the HTI1 work group that came up with recommendations for the fact that we need to find a way to have, some sort of auditing or revelation of disclosures or listing of disclosures. But putting, Devin went into some detail about how that was incredibly difficult. And, the last time that the HIT policy committee took a look at this, what I was talking about, I mean, I think that's important, but as a separate topic, I'm talking about aggregated data and the fact that we have given hospital institutions and companies a lot of latitude to be able to do whatever they want with de-identified data and to be able to use it for all sorts of things. And I think by and large, that's probably a good thing, but I think those uses and the specific research and activities that come out of those uses are something that should be disclosed. I mean, we've given them, again, a lot of latitude. They're making a lot of money. They're spending a lot of time and resources to make the data work and to make it usable. So that's fine, but the data does generate, is generated by an individual, and we have a right to know how that data is being used.
Thanks, and I think one challenge that I'm having with that comment, Anna, is that let's say we generate a de-identified data set that's going to be used by some research. If we then notify the individuals where that data came from about the use, it's almost like we are re-identifying that data, which then leads to other challenges. So I don't know if that makes sense, but that's the issue that I'm thinking, that is once you de-identify, you shouldn't be letting anyone know that their data is being used for specific research purposes.
But the difficulty with not sharing that information is that you're then putting the patient in the position of not knowing if their data was misused. It goes back to that accountability and not sharing any information about disclosures in the first place. If I don't know where my data was shared, it makes it very difficult for me to determine whether it was misused or not. And in my particular case, I would, as long, if you've got my full medical record, it's not going to be de-identified if you've got two pieces of information, because I'm a huge outlier with respect to some identifiable criterion. So that's a whole different story.
So this is an amazing conversation. So obviously it's something that we need to kind of walk through a bit more. I believe that Michelle and team, that they have captured all of the various different perspectives, and then maybe we can see how they distill it down, because we are talking about a range of items here as well. And so it'll be really great to see how they distill it. And then once it goes into the crosswalk, we can then hopefully build upon each one of these areas and see also if they have their own kind of streams of recommendations and activities from each one of these topics as well. Yeah, so we only have about 22 more minutes. So we do want to make sure that we, if there's any additional topics that anyone wants to put on, and especially we do have some members that have not mentioned anything yet, don't want to put you on the spot, but your voice and your insights and your ideas are so incredibly important. So if there's any additional topics that's top of mind for anyone, this will be a wonderful time to share them as well.
Madel, we've talked a little bit about special populations and looking at health equity pieces. I think we might want to call some special attention to individuals with disabilities, especially from a public health kind of perspective, thinking about what are special data needs in that space to help both public health and care providers across a broad spectrum of use cases and information, whether you're talking about emergency response, emergency evacuation, emergency plans with things like decontaminating individuals who have to use wheelchairs, special planning in that space, because you can't just use necessarily a regular decontamination approach if you're dealing with someone in a power wheelchair, as an example. We're looking at a broad spectrum of other pieces, and our data standards don't necessarily do a great job of collecting relevant data.
So Ike, I will give you +5 on that, if not more. This is actually another one of my topics on my list, and you came at it from a public health standpoint, which I fully agree with every single thing that you said. But then I also, you mentioned at the very end, even with looking at standards. So one of the things that even within my organization that we have really are doing laser focus on and trying to prioritize is the appropriate capture of information for our patients that are living with diverse abilities, and making sure that we even are capturing the additional accommodations that they may need in order to provide the most appropriate and equitable care, so that when they come into a healthcare facility, that we are already anticipating what they may need so that they can actually take part in the same level of engagement with their providers as someone else may. And so I think all the different pieces that you brought up about that exchange of information from a public health standpoint and the emergency preparation standpoint is key. But I would also say, and I know we don't have Sarah on as the co-chair, but you're definitely on from ISIWG, even the standards, and forgive me about my lack of knowledge because I've been looking into this, even the key standards of what information we need to collect in our systems for appropriate interoperability between care settings is another area, because I think that all of us throughout the country and globally can do a much better job thinking and caring and anticipating the various different needs of all of our patients and communities that are living with diverse abilities, both cognitive as well as mental, as well as physical.
Absolutely. Thanks for that. And I would add on, it's not just access to care once at a healthcare facility, it's access to potentially the healthcare facility in and of itself, mm-hmm. thinking about transportation or wherever visit. Might be a better tool depending on what your particular needs are of the moment.
Absolutely. And we can even expand that even further now we're getting into thinking about all those social drivers of health. But one of the other pieces that I had from my list as well is making still more inclusive health technology. So as we're thinking about telemedicine, and we spoke about this a little bit in our annual report group last year, but I don't really think we went as deep into it, especially when it came to ability status, but making sure that we do not have any widening divides between our emerging technologies when it comes to AI or telemedicine or virtual health with those that do have diverse abilities. Because again, as you all know, I'm always concerned about us having advances, but then leaving people or populations behind because we're not inclusive with what we're thinking about when it comes to our new advances. So yes, agree with you in totality. I think that it is a very important topic to really spell out in our annual report work this upcoming year.
That's kind of a vulnerable subject. Also thinking about it in the context of AI and computer decision support tools, that decision support tools need to accommodate individuals with disabilities as they're looking at their data so that they're not making recommendations that may not be a good fit for the patient that cannot follow the recommendation of the CDS, or there's some other contraindicated kind of factor that the CDS is based on but doesn't work, or has bad data because there's a background factor based on an individual's disability or other condition.
Correct. Our full underrepresentation in the training models to begin with, so therefore incorrect recommendations. Yes, fully agree with you.
Thank you.
Love the topic, Ike. Thank you. Jim?
One other topic, just moving to a different topic that to me is an opportunity. Is sort of a next step of what we're seeing with TEFCA, right? So you guys may have heard me talk about before I came over to CDC at HCA last year, I had the team look at, all these CCDs that are being sent, right? So we signed up for Commonwealth, and so we receive all these CCDs. And so I had the team look at it, and many of you have heard me say that there's no guidance for what the source is, what the expectations are on the source. So if we look at the value of TEFCA, it's the recipient, right, who's trying to care for the patient and needs enough information to actually make it useful. And so the sender, the source of information in information exchange with TEFCA, for example, knows that they're supposed to submit it in the format of USCDI. They know the transport mechanism. But many centers were just defining what they had to send as the last encounter. Maybe it was a skin tag removal, right? The VA goes 2 years back and sends USCDI anything from the past 2 years. Many places do 90 days. So nowhere do I see anyone addressing expectations around how far back people need to be able to go when they're sending a USCDI payload through TEFCA, for example. I think it's important because then there's unpredictability on the part of the receiver, and the value of TEFCA goes down because you may be getting a bunch of CCDs, but if each of the senders is interpreting it differently, last encounter versus 2 years of info, you have no idea whether you're getting complete information or not. So just a suggestion that maybe we amend that ONC address expectations around the amount of data that's being sent.
Leo, is it okay if I ask Jim a quick question?
Of course.
Yeah. So, Jim, I fully agree. I think this is a fascinating, important topic for us to address. I know you mentioned that this was your experience through Commonwealth. Do we know if that's the same experience with, for instance, Care Quality and others? And the only reason why I mention that is because I'm currently working, and I think I've mentioned this before, with creating a very special system that's linking several academic medical centers and other large health systems with the federally qualified health centers. So of course we're using full interoperability through all of our diverse EHRs through Care Quality. And we actually have that conversation about how far back that we should go in terms of pulling record or being able to pull record records. And we were able to actually set it. And there's lots of different discussions, exactly as you were mentioning, about going much further back. And then some people were like, no, we don't want all those that different, that large amount of my data. We just need to go back 2 or 3 years. So do we know if there's, my question is, do we know if there's differences based off of care commonwealth or care quality, or now, of course, thinking about everything through TEFCA, if there are kind of built-in limits or to your point, we need to make sure we have some clarity and standards.
I think, in my opinion, a commonwealth, sorry, those are just conduits. Those are just pipes sending the info. It's really back at the EMR level, right? And the provider. So when we met with Epic 2-3 months ago, and they have built capabilities for 90 days back. Well, based on what, right? Mm-hmm. And what is Oracle doing? And so a lot of it has to do with the source system. Some source systems purge their data into a data warehouse, and the EMR only has a limited amount of data, right? So I think that maybe one of the recommendations is to do an analysis, or, you know, identify what the current state is, or an RFI as part of that ONC should explore the content and the amount of data, because I don't think it's based on the QHIN.
Right.
I think it's based on the source.
Yeah. And I agree with some type of analysis, because I can tell you, we've been able to pull data from definitely much larger, much farther out than 90 days into the CCDs that are coming through. So
those are academic centers probably too, right?
Well, no, there are actually some federally qualified health centers as well.
Yeah. Well, I have no doubt that they can. Like, I remember even at HCA, we were trying to figure out, well, how do we arbitrarily decide how much to send? And we just decided.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I think that the idea that everyone would decide exactly the same thing is probably pretty low.
Correct.
And so at least if people knew, like, even if the whole country knew that, oh, it's 90 days right now, right, then at least everyone would know what to expect. If I'm looking for any chest x-ray that occurred 5 years ago to compare my new tuberculosis chest x-ray to, I know it's not going to be in the 90 days, right? Mm-hmm. Versus trying to guess. So I guess I say all that to say that doing an analysis and coming up with a set of recommendations may be useful. I don't know if FHIR will fix it. Like, these FHIR converters, they only have access to the data that's available in the EMR, right? And so I think even when FHIR, you think, well, FHIR means that the requester of the data can indicate how far back it's set. Well, that's only true if the IT systems on the source side are set up to have the FHIR converters have access to data that far back, right? So I think even in this push world today of CCDs, and in the future world, it's probably worth setting expectations and defining how far back. Mm-hmm. Just my opinion on what maybe this annual report group could recommend that might be new, but adjacent to TEFCA.
Yeah, I'm thinking here, Jim, that this might be a interesting topic for the standards work group to consider maybe the possibilities of making adjustments to standards in such a way that the requester can actually determine what should that range be, you know, 9 days, a year, two, whatnot. But that also implies that systems would have to be flexible to be adaptable to the requests coming in. But, you know, I can't see where it can go in all kinds of directions on how what the load should look like. So I think it's a great topic, but I'm also thinking here that maybe since we have another work group, they're only, as you know, in high tech, is the annual report and the standard one. So that might be a great topic on that front, but definitely including the report. Steve?
Really is important at a base level, because without the data requester getting useful information back, it's not really going to do them a whole lot of good for continuity of care. So there does need to be some kind of frame in that space. And it may not be in the annual report work groups purview necessarily to go in and dig deep on what that standard might be, but I do think it's a broad enough issue that probably needs to get recognized here and then perhaps pushed. Kind of a companion tool would be a set of regulators, not from a legal regulation standpoint, but from a volume perspective, just to help manage traffic on the size of information so that a person or an entity sending data was not sending too much data and the receiver wasn't going to end up receiving too much data to overwhelm either of their systems. So I think there's some opportunity for modifying standards to accommodate both those tools. But I think the fundamental element is ensuring that the data being sent is sufficient enough to meet the requester's need.
Thanks, Steve. That makes sense. More along the lines of what I was saying, Medel, you have your hand up?
You know, I did, but this is just, I think that these are such important topics for us to discuss. And yes, as we put them on the crosswalk, we're going to look at the various different recommendations and then also prioritize them as well. And so what I was thinking was exactly what Ike and Jim just put something in. There may be some opportunities for us to suggest new innovative approaches, because while there's one, it could be a push and then you filter through receiving, it may also just be, I want to actually query X number or X years of data for my purposes, because in Jim's situation, for instance, of trying to understand a patient and seeing if they need treatment for tuberculosis, he absolutely may need to go back 5-7 years. While there may be another reason to start pulling through some of that data for another case use, and which they only need to have the past 6 months. So there's just a lot of various different things that we can recommend, I believe, as the annual report work group, as well as for as well overall as high tech, and we'll kind of be able to flesh that out a little bit more with the crosswalk. Just as a time check, we have about 6 more minutes until we have to go to public comment. So any new topics that anyone, especially for those that we have not heard from, but yes, Jim, you as well. But I do want to give a chance to anyone who we may not have heard from during this meeting as well. Any other topics from our work group members?
Adele, just one adjacent new topic. Mm-hmm. And one suggestion. So we've been talking, like TEFCA has been all about the pipes, right? And USCDI Plus, and et cetera, have been about the data format. And what I'm suggesting is that we recommend ONC pursue data content. Mm-hmm. How far back? But another one I put in the chat is data segmentation, right? Mm-hmm. So you have the ability to actually identify subsets of data that either shouldn't be shared or should be, right? And so that, maybe that falls under the bigger rubric of, hey, ONC, instead of just format and transport standards, let's talk about content standards.
And when we add quality on top of that.
Yes, that's right.
Exactly. I agree. I think we now have the bones, and now we have to fill in the bones with all of the true content that is going to be relevant and actionable. So great, great points there.
Not a vegan-friendly example, but yes.
I just said bones. You notice I didn't say meat. I said bones only. We'll call it pescatarian approach. All right. So any other comments, though, from anyone that we have not heard from? Eliel, I'm looking as well.
Don't see any, but I would emphasize for the team here to do take a look at this list of topics and send us anything else that comes up. I think that we actually have a very good list already based on the things that we kind of left off on last year's report, and it's not here shown on this screen. I think if we scroll down, you see details about LTPAC support and other things that are quite important. So I do, want to suggest that everybody take another look at this list and think about and suggest additional topics. This is the time for it, because then when we start working on the content and suggestions and recommendations, we may be limited on what we can do with the time that we have.
Well, if there's no other comments, oh, well, first, any other topics? Any other comments or suggestions? We're not seeing any either. And so if there's no other topics that need to be addressed or any other comments or questions, it seems like we may be able to move to our public comment. So Seth, is it possible for us to do so now?
Yes, we can move to open the meeting for public comment. So if you can open us up for public comment, please. And for folks who are on the Zoom, if you'd like to make a comment, please use the hand raise function, which is located in the Zoom toolbar at the bottom of your screen. And if you are participating by phone only today, you can press *9 to raise your hand. Once called upon, press *6 to mute and unmute your line. So we will give folks a chance, a minute here to tee up with any questions or comments. All right, I'm seeing no hands raised. Sel, do we have any comments on the line? No comments. Okay, Medell and Elio, back to you to close us out.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Seth. And thank you also to our public for being here. And please, if you ever do have any suggestions or comments, we appreciate your insights and we would definitely welcome them at all times. So once again, everyone, thank you for having and coming and participating in our annual report work group meeting today. I think we have been able to expand our topic list to really cover a wide variety of issues and concerns and recommendations. So very much looking forward to creating our crosswalk together so we can truly solidify our recommendations for our work group. So thank you all. And Lal, I'll turn it to you.
Thanks, Mandel, and thanks, everybody. I think that was a good discussion. If those were easy topics, we wouldn't be here. So I know they are hard, but I think we move to the next phase now, talking about what are some ideas on to address these specific topics. But like I said, you know, if anything comes up, just consider sending to us at this round, because the next meeting we're going to be working deeper into the specific topics that we just selected and went over. So thank you so much and hope to see you again soon.
Have a good afternoon, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye, everybody.